on air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Coming up today, one East Coast fishery converting to a different coloured oyster.
Well, it's up to the perception of the viewer, I guess, from looking at it from when you bring the frames up. At the moment, they are very golden, but when they stand by themselves as matures, they'll probably be an orangey colour.
And saving storm-damaged apples for a new product.
And so we're on an adventure now with a new business that we've worked on for almost 3 years now with dried fruit. Yeah, we're doing our first product, which is vacuum-dried apple crisps. So we were devastated by a storm that we got hit by 3 years ago.
Thinking outside the square with oysters and apples, those stories coming up shortly. G'day, Tony with you on this Monday. Well, during the program, we're all hoping Ariane Titmus will win gold in Tokyo. And where we also bring you some thoughts on the future use of robotics in the agriculture sector. Are you already using robotics on your farm? Is all going smoothly? Our expert says it's either utopia or dystopia. That story coming up for you shortly. And you can stay in touch via the text line on 0438 922 936. 0438 922 936 is that number. First up to finance and a new type of loan for farmers. And the amount of interest that a Queensland beef business will pay in its bank loan will vary according to its ability to treat animals well, boost workplace health and safety, and cut greenhouse gas emissions. In what's been described as a first for Australian agriculture, Stockyard Group, which runs a 20,000-head feedlot on the Darling Downs, has entered into the sustainability-linked loan with the Commonwealth Bank. While many of the details, including the specific metrics, are confidential, Stockyard Group's Managing Director Lockie Hart says the difference between meeting the sustainability targets could be worth tens of thousands of dollars to the business.
So the bank actually came to us understanding where Stockyard is situated in this space and said, look, I think we can help you. How about we align the funding, so the interest rates, to your sustainability targets so that, you know, each year if you manage to meet those improved and stretched targets that we set, you're able to get a discount with regards to the funding of that loan.
So what are these metrics? What are the targets that you need to meet? To what extent will that affect the interest rate?
So there are three areas that we're trying to meet. One is around reducing our emissions. One is about improving our animal wellbeing standards. And the third one is around improving safetiness of our workplace environment for our people. Now, there's actually five targets within those three areas. I won't go into the specifics.
Why not?
Well, because I think it's commercially confidential of what we're trying to achieve. But, you know, what I can tell you, though, that this whole program that we are working with CBA does meet international credentials. So these are credentials that set a standard for banks around the world with regards to setting sustainability-linked loans. And then we are getting that audited by a third party, in our case, by EY, so a highly respected and well-known brand that audits our whole system on behalf of ourselves.
And will that EY report, would that be made public, or how are you actually going to communicate to your customers that you are meeting these metrics if you do in fact meet them?
You know, our plan is that we will put these reports up onto our website. Eventually I hope that our brand will become a carbon neutral brand, and I think transparency is extremely important.
Lockie, what is this loan worth to Stockyard Group? Not in terms of how much you're borrowing, but in terms of the incentive that Commonwealth Bank has offered you. What's the difference in the interest, basically?
Well, it's tens of thousands of dollars for us each year if we meet those targets, or it's tens of thousands of dollars if we don't and we have to pay extra. So, you know, it's a substantial amount of money for us, for a small family-owned operation. It's certainly a strong incentive for us to meet these targets. But I think it's also been the very first agricultural company in Australia to have these loans to sustainability. Hopefully it's going to promote to the broader industry and the agricultural sector in its entirety these innovative approaches that our bankers and our people who are funding us with capital are looking towards to help us achieve these sustainability outcomes.
You mentioned that the industry has a target, carbon neutral by 2030. We don't see any sort of government intervention in terms of climate mitigation policies, really, when it comes to the agriculture sector. Do you believe that if the industry is to meet its targets, it's going to come through the corporates, things like banks saying we'll offer lower interest rates to farmers that consider their emissions, rather than actually coming from Canberra?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because I think the industry has been looking for some direction from governments in this area. And I suppose when there was an absence of a voice or a direction from government, I thought the industry did take the initiative and said, okay, well, you know, we're going to try and do this ourselves. And that's what I love about our red meat industry here in Australia. We are self-governed. We don't rely on government handouts. We don't rely on government to always prop us up or assist us in any particular way. We control our own destiny as an industry.
Stockyard Group's Managing Director Lockie Hart speaking there with Kath Sullivan about the sustainability loan. Well, Grant Cairns from the Commonwealth Bank says the sustainability-linked loan has been driven by the bank's customers more than its shareholders.
Certainly our customers, number one, are very, very interested. You know, certainly shareholders are interested in this. You know, our institutional investors are interested in this. I think the community is interested in a more sustainable future as well. So I think there's many people, there's many stakeholders are interested in the future of sustainability and the role that, you know, Australia's largest bank can play in supporting that.
Do you expect that we'll see more sustainability-linked loans in Australian ag?
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly it's a trend that we're seeing globally. We're seeing, you know, strong demand for sustainability-linked loans in many other jurisdictions. You know, certainly, you know, we've seen good demand for our green loans. We've seen very strong demand for our energy-efficient equipment loans where there is an incentive. And, you know, there's a deep level of curiosity. Farmers are looking to more efficient plant. They're always looking for, you know, how can I be more efficient, more productive, look after my land even more sustainably. I think all of these things are on the mind. So I think there will be increased demand for these types of products and innovations in the future.
That's Grant Cairns from the Commonwealth Bank, the head of regional agribusiness there, talking to Kath Sullivan about the sustainability-linked loan. And there's more information on that story online at ABC Rural and also our ABC Rural Facebook page, as well as the lovely story from the Nubina CWA branch with David Barnett-Clements, our rural reporter, who put up that story at the weekend. And it's on our ABC Rural Facebook page too. Some great comments. Louise says she joined our local CWA a few years ago, though she rarely makes it to the meetings due to working FIFO. She says our president is 99 and one of our other members is 100. And she says it's lovely spending time with them. Good on you, Louise. Well, Beryl says, congratulations, you've been a CWA. Similar situation in border region CWA in Queensland. Two CWA halls were to be sold, but the local communities amassed to save the halls, and Cunningham CWA is a vibrant branch now, and more recently the Mount Colliery CWA as well. Plenty of comments on our ABC Rural Facebook page about the CWA branch at Nubina with 40 new members. Still to come on the Country Hour, apple crisps, golden oysters. And what does the future of robotics look like on farms?
Every Olympics, there's been something in the lead up. Athens, they're worried about it just being finished for us to compete. Beijing, it was pollution. Rio, it was the Zika virus. And, yeah, you know, where we were competing, there'd been a lot of gastro the year before. But this is just unprecedented. The biggest thing you want to do is get to the start line healthy. You're wrapped up in cotton wool for that last sort of month or two.
Leon Compton.
Do you ever row a bit injured and not tell anyone about it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Weekdays from 8:30 a.m.
You just want to compete.
On ABC Radio Hobart. Coast to Coast, this is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Our text line number 0438 922 936, if you want to stay in touch. Got some comments to make and tell us what the weather's like where you are. 0438 922 936. The police website is where the latest road closures are and roads affected by snow and ice. There's a few of them in the area, and we'll check in with the Bureau very shortly. Well, farmers and rural businesses are grappling with the question of what robotics will mean for agriculture within the next few decades. And while we've seen an increase in how many robots appear at field days or tech demos, when will they become used in a widespread way? One academic has put forward two scenarios when it comes to robotics, one he calls utopia and the other he calls dystopia. Lucas Forbes reports.
Could the farms of the future be worked by swarms of small intelligent robots doing a lot of the work that's just too costly to pay humans to do? Or perhaps large automated tractors and seeders will dominate the farm of the future. University of Hohenheim agricultural economist Dr. Thomas Dorm says small intelligent robots in agriculture could make farming far more efficient and be better for the environment.
So in the utopian, we kind of combine the best of two worlds. We have high yield, but we're also producing very sustainably. Currently, many of the practices from the utopia are not really feasible because they're very labor-intensive. And labor is scarce in farming. It's also expensive. Therefore, you know, farms grew in size. We use tractors. We use agrochemicals. All of these things mainly to save agricultural labor. And much of the agroecological farming, it addresses these issues in principle, but it's labor-intensive and also often lower-yielding. Now, with robots, we could address these issues. So we could have swarms of robots roaming around the field. We could return to having smaller plot sizes, integrate landscape features, such as small streams. We could have more trees again. We could have a much higher diversity of different crops. We may use much less agrochemicals as well, while not really compromising on yield.
However, Dr. Dorm says it's also possible large, crude robots could dominate the landscape and may lead to more environmental degradation and chemical use.
In the dystopia, everything is kind of structured around the robots. So robots may actually work best where things are most structured and most monotone. Maybe even bigger fields, we have monocultures. We may have fences around the fields because we don't want people or animals to go into the fields because that would interfere with the robots. Some people may think that one uses even more agrochemicals because once the operators are removed from the fields, that's less of a concern. So here a lot of things have gone wrong. I think mainly this would be a missed potential because we could do so much more with robots.
Agricultural economist Dr. Thomas Dorm speaking. Swarm Farm Robotics is an agricultural robot startup in Queensland. Swarm Farm's Andrew Bate is optimistic about the future of robotics.
You know, even at a very basic level, you know, we are so reliant on either pesticides and chemicals to kill weeds or mechanical disturbance of soil to kill weeds, and we don't do things like pulling weeds out of the ground, which were done years ago, but are no longer considered practical or possible or efficient in modern agriculture simply because of large machines and the way we've industrialised agriculture. So, you know, robotics is going to offer new pathways to ways that we already know that are very effective and very good at killing weeds, for instance, but we don't kind of add to the, you know, techniques and farming methods we use nowadays to kill weeds. We just rely on the easy things or the things that are very easily kind of industrialised across our farms. So I think it's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what robotics is going to open up. But it is genuinely, I think, the next big wave of technology and production, I guess, revolutions that are going to go through agriculture.
Swarm Farms, Andrew Bate speaking. Jamie Grant farms in Queensland's Darling Downs and has been using robots to spray weeds on his property for the past 2 years. Mr. Grant says one of his favourite things about the robots is that they don't complain or talk back.
But the benefits are they just keep working. They don't have holidays. They don't get sick. They just keep working. And so when we get to one end of the farm, we just turn them around and send them back again. And they don't whinge. And so it just works really well.
But aside from not complaining, Mr. Grant says the robots have also saved him money on spraying.
by using the robot continuously, we're spraying now proactively rather than reactively. So we're spraying smaller weeds, and therefore the sprayers are on for less time. So we've cut our percentages back even more than we used to have with the camera sprays.
Could you give me sort of any indication as to like how much you've managed to reduce your chemical use by?
Oh, well, just on a sort of a fairly typical fallow paddock where you just got odd weeds, you might be running 1 or 2% of the whole field. So you're saving 98% of chemical. And on after a rain where you've got a general flush of weeds, the worst I've got to is 30%. So you've still got a 70% saving. So it's big time.
In addition to the savings, Mr. Grant says the robots on his property let him get on with the parts of the job that he enjoys.
This is probably not going to cut my labour force down much. What it'll do is take the menial tasks out of it. It's the fun part of farming is actually working out how you're going to do it and setting it all up and getting it going. Actually, sitting on a tractor is not that much fun.
Darling Downs farmer Jamie Grant speaking there to Lucas Forbes about the future of robotics. Well, back here in Tasmania, golden oysters have been around for roughly 15 years or so, mainly as a luxury product from a few select farms. But now Melshell Sea Farms at Dolphin Sands on the east coast has decided to convert their entire stock over to the variety. Owner Ian Melrose has told Luke Radford why they're going all in on the Tassie Gold.
Well, at the moment, with the shop being closed due to the lack of tourists to Tasmania, we've basically turned all of our production to the wholesale market into Melbourne and Sydney, and also to the local restaurants, i.e. Freycinet Lodge, etc. And so we're supplying those shops and wholesalers at the moment until Cass's shop reboots, hopefully in November, if Australia can stay under control.
When it comes to the actual farm side of things, you're currently going through the process of changing the type of oyster you're using, is that right?
Yeah, we're trialling a Tassie Gold, and we've got quite a lot of stock coming through, and we're hoping to have that come online in about 12 months' time. Well, a small percentage of the fast runners will be coming through, and that will be an orange oyster.
An orange oyster, so not quite golden colour?
Well, it's up to the perception of the viewer, I guess. From looking at it from when you bring the frames up at the moment, they are very golden, but when they stand by themselves as matures, they'll probably be an orangey colour.
So walk me through this Tassie Gold. Where's it come from?
Well, it's just like the redhead in humans. So it's that, whatever the percentage is in humans, it's probably down around about 2%. There is the red oyster, or orange oyster, Tassie Gold. And that has just been bred for us to be taken just that variety, that genetic makeup.
So this is the same species you're running already, so taste-wise there won't be a difference?
There won't be a difference in taste at all. Yeah. And we have found that there are some really good properties, for the want of a better word, with the Tassie Gold. They are more resilient to floods and etc. They grow very quickly, which has its own problems for our farm because of the deep water, but they do have some many benefits as well.
The way you're talking about it, it almost sounds like it's almost entirely plus sides. It's a prettier oyster to look at. It's more resilient. It grows faster. What are there any downsides to it?
We'll talk about that in 12 months' time.
So how far along with the process are you at the moment?
I guess the oysters, we received the stock in February. And so the oysters are now up to about 20 mil, 30 mil. And so that's where we're at there.
So they're pretty much little babies at the moment, and then you're going to put them out in the river pens here before you take them out to the deep sea?
Oh, there's all sorts of magic tricks that go on that goes from the ocean to the river to back to the ocean. Pretty much that's how it rolls.
And you're hoping to get this as your entire stock, so everything you sell will be Tassie Gold?
It's looking that way. When Cameron's of Tas did the run for us, they were only looking at a small number of oysters, but to do the run for ourselves and another farm, and it was so successful they're inundated with Tassie Gold, so we said we'd take them on. So yes, we will more than likely have the whole farm stocked with Tassie Golds.
Have they been done somewhere else so far? Is this kind of brand new territory that you're stepping into, or?
It was experimented with probably, I'm guessing here, probably 15 years ago by a couple of other farmers, and they actually came up with the name, and then it kind of dropped by the wayside. There was a few people that didn't like the type of things that they did, i.e. grow too quickly. But then we found that all of the traits that we've found is what I've touched on before, is their survival is very good. So we decided to give it a go.
Is that super important for you at the moment? Because obviously things like POMs are floating around and the changing climate obviously throws curveballs at everyone. So is survivability a trait that you're particularly keen on?
Absolutely. And I think one of the things I do like about the Tassie Gold is that there haven't been too much meddling around with in genetics. What you see is what you get. It's a basic oyster.
Is it this a natural process that's resulted in these baby oysters?
Correct. Yeah. Absolutely. There's no genetic manipulation at all. So it's just breeding the oysters, taking the oysters up to 28 degrees and then having them breed in captivity, so to speak.
Just quickly, run me through it. You said obviously the growing too big was a little bit undesirable, or growing too fast, I should say. Why is that?
They tend to start to look like bananas, not like an oyster. I know that's quite bizarre. They go like fingery or like bananas, and that's not desired in the marketplace. So you have to be really have your wits about them to stop that from happening.
Have you figured out a way to make it so that doesn't happen?
Yeah, I mean, we've got a few tricks up our sleeve that they kind of run into a brick wall and then go out, if that makes sense. That's something we'll keep in-house, but looking forward to a good season and extremely cold winter, which is making a very nice tasting oyster at the moment. So it's nice to see that the locals, Tasmanians, are starting to consume a lot more oysters since I've been farming. And hopefully it keeps up.
So are you kind of, in a way, resurrecting the Tassie Gold?
Yeah, I think that's the best way to put it. Yeah, it's a idea of that 15 years ago, and we'll give it another crack.
Yeah, that's the owner of Melshell Sea Farms, Ian Melrose, speaking there with Luke Radford about the Tassie Gold oyster. Well, the Mantovani family has been growing fruit in Cobram for more than 30 years. A few years ago, when a massive hailstorm ripped through their orchard, damaging all of their crop, they knew they had to find new ways to keep the horticulture business alive. They heard about vacuum drying technology to come out of Taiwan from one of their workers, and they decided to bring it to their farm and set up one of Australia's first factories to use it, taking a lead from Tasmanian company Forager Fruits, which has been processing fruit that way since 2015. Annie Brown got to take a tour of the new factory and see how the waste was being turned into chips.
Okay, so
I've
got to go in? Yeah,
you just go in, and now I'll close the door behind you.
All right, it's going to give me an air shower.
Operation is completed. Please leave through the
door. So my name's John Mantovani from Cobram. We have about 170 acres of stone fruit and pine fruit, so apples, peaches, nectarines, apricots. And so we're on an adventure now with a new business that we've worked on for almost 3 years now with dried fruit. Yeah, we're doing our first product, which is vacuum dried apple crisps. So we were devastated by a storm that we got hit by 3 years ago on a new property that we just purchased. So in that year, we had to still pick every bit of fruit off the hail-affected fruit off the trees, still run it through our packing shed. And, yeah, the cows got a good feed and the pigs, that's about it that year. So, yeah, and we know the devastation has happened to us a few times now, and you're always on edge sort of come prior to harvest, as all of us growers are. So it just seems to be happening more frequent these days with the storms and stuff. At the time, we were really sort of scratching our heads. There's got to be something else out there. We were lucky enough to get a hold of a worker at the time that knew a guy overseas from Taiwan, and he's been working on these customised machines, new technology, vacuum dried. So we got him over this way, and been working with him ever since to implement our factory that we've built by scratch.
So what happens is, when we put it in, once temperature goes up to around, say, 110, 120, we'll turn on the vacuum. You'll hear very, very loud sound. That's when, that's where all the moisture, remaining moisture, it will get sucked out, and then it will become crunchy.
Tell me a bit about the man who's invented this technology.
Yep, so Polo, so he's Taiwanese. He's been working in in foods manufacturing for a good decades, 3 or 4 decades, I think he said. So he puts a lot of work in it, and with the machines being customised, it's all done by his himself. So, yeah, a lot of time and thoughts and gone in. A lot of you see him now still tweaking stuff all the time. So it's not sort of it's always an ongoing thing to perfect it. So, and I think to the product that we've got today, you can be sort of very proud of what we've come up with. So it is different to what you see out there. So it really, it's like you describe it like a potato chip. We don't add nothing to it, no oils, no preservatives, no nothing like that. So it's simply just the fruit itself.
What's great about this is that you're taking wastage and turning it into something that you can then put into a supermarket and sell.
Yep.
What are you saving on wastage by doing it this way?
Any given year, you're always going to have at least 10 to 12% on your sort of waste and seconds fruit out of your crop. So no matter what, even on a good year, you always have that we could sort of utilise and use. So, but any, like I said before, hailstorm, so any punches and all that, that can be used. With the stone fruit, we have a thing where split stone, that's quite common. We can use the fruit out of that, where the stone's split in the middle, we can still use the fruit because we do have a de-seeding machine, which is our other, you could say, little business as well that we do in the factory. And we've done a bit of work over the summer with Berenberg Jams, and we took a lot of de-seeding from our plums and apricots and sent them off to Berenberg, and they're currently on the shelves, which is good.
I know you're only 6 months into production, seven months in, but where do you sort of see this going in the next 5-10 years?
Yeah, we hope to make it grow and to be another avenue for all, different farmers if we can. So the real aim is to get in the supermarkets in the next sort of 12 months or so. Beyond that's export. We think it's this dry fruit is a bigger market overseas as well, but it's sort of so that's a good little aim that we hope to get going as well in the future. So.
Yes, that's John Mantovani from MP Harvest speaking to Annie Brown in their Apple Crisps business, vacuum freeze-drying fruit damaged by the weather. Time now to check the latest on the weather, and Luke Johnston joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Luke.
Hey, Tony, how are you?
Yeah, I must admit, I am smiling. It's fantastic to see all that work put in by a young Tasmanian and her family to move from Launceston in the north to Brisbane to better her chances. And, gee, it's paid off. It's just brilliant. A brilliant story.
Yeah, I just watched it myself, and I did see the dance that the coach did. And yeah, it was certainly something. I'll give him that.
Yeah, it was unique. Yeah. Not the sort of dance I can do these days.
No, I don't even think I could do that, to be honest.
No. Anyway, let's have a look at the weather with a smile on our face. Have we had much rainfall?
Yeah, there's been a reasonable amount, up to 9 a.m. this morning. There's been a good odd 20 to 40 millimetres about the west of the state, with 5 to 10 millimetres falling into the far southeast, less than 1 millimetre to the east coast, though, further east, and the east coast was fairly dry. It's going to be a lot of snow melt affecting rain gauges in the coming days, particularly at elevated sites. So Lake Margaret had 60 millimetres up to 9 a.m., but I suspect some of that's a combination of A, it's a wet spot, and B, it probably had a bit of snow there in recent days as well. Since 9 a.m, we've had another 2 to 5 millimetres about the west and far northeast, including Flinders Island. And there's some more showers on the way, mostly about the west and north of the state, but Hobart and the southeast are just getting some lighter showers coming over now and for the rest of the afternoon. But it's going to remain mostly dry about the east coast today.
Okay. What sort of start to the day? Was it very cold?
I haven't looked at minimum temperatures as yet, sorry.
That's all right.
I was more focused on rainfall.
We'll take that on notice. Well, let's have a look to the future now, the outlook. What are we looking at, Luke?
Well, more of the same, pretty much. Lots of fronts coming through this week, a big mix of cold fronts and warm fronts, but they're all just bringing lots of rain, particularly about the west and the north. Pretty well every day there's going to be showers about the west and north of the state. Less rainfall is expected for the southeast and the east coast, though. We're sort of stuck in this west to northwesterly flow. Tomorrow there'll be some showers about 15 to 25 millimetres into the west, 5 to 15 millimetres about the north and central north, with around 3 to 5 millimetres in the southeast, and less than 3 millimetres making it into the east coast. going to become a little bit windy during the course of tomorrow as a more significant front approaches later in the day. So we're seeing wind increasing Tuesday evening into Wednesday, and we're likely to have a severe weather warning current for damaging winds for Tuesday evening, mostly in the north, and then extending to other areas on Wednesday. So keep an eye out for that. We're going to issue that later, probably tomorrow morning, I would say, by the time we've had a proper assessment of the damaging wind scenario. And then it's going to become pretty wet again, so some more showers Wednesday with that cold front moving through, and then snow down to around 700 metres Wednesday night into Thursday. So not as low as we saw on the weekend. We had snow down to around 200 to 300 metres with some lower snow flurries to nearer to sea level in some parts of Tasmania over the weekend. It was certainly a cold one.
Yeah, it definitely was. Is the prospect this weekend going to be a little bit better?
Yeah, kind of. It'll be a bit warmer.
Oh, good.
A bit warmer, but not much. There's another cold front coming across the state. So if you were to pick two wet days this coming week, it's going to be Wednesday's front and a front on Saturday. So more rainfall around, and then snow down to around 800 metres on Sunday. So not a great deal in variation in conditions across Tasmania this week. It's just going to be wet in the west and north and slightly less wet about the east.
And windy, as you say.
Yeah, a bit windy, particularly Tuesday night and Wednesday.
Okay, what warnings are we looking at?
A whole heap of warnings. So most of them are wind-driven. I'll start with the one that's not, though, because it's probably more significant to some people up in the northeast. So we have a minor flood warning still current for the North Esk River. There's no gauges that are above minor at the moment, but we're expecting with rainfall that's coming that we might start to see some river gauges rise to above minor again later on tonight and during the course of tomorrow as well. So keep an eye out for that if you're up in the northeast around the North Esk River. Other than that, though, we've got a gale warning today, current for southern coastal waters from Tasman Island to Lower Rocky Point for west and northwesterly winds, and a strong wind warning for all remaining coastal waters except the lower east from Wineglass Bay to Tasman Island. Tomorrow, gales about southern, west and the northern coastal waters from southeast Cape to the northern tip of Flinders Island for more northerly winds tomorrow, and a strong wind warning for all remaining coastal waters, the Central Plateau Lakes, Southwest Lakes and Storm Bay.
And just for the record, because I don't think too many people will be heading out to the coastal waters and swell.
Yeah, so a bit of wind. If it's not 20 knots, it's nearer to 30 knots, about the north and west extending to east of Flinders Island in the afternoon. About the east coast, a little bit more sheltered there with westerly winds at 15 to 20 knots today, but everywhere is going to be increasing tomorrow, particularly during the course of the day, with northwesterly winds 15 to 25 knots, increasing to 25 to 30 in the west in the afternoon, then 30 to 40 in the evening. Winds everywhere else will increase to 25 to 30 knots tomorrow evening. The swell westerly 4 to 5 metres, about the west and south. Our Cape Sorrel wave rider buoy is around 4.8 metres significant wave height. About the north through Bass Strait, westerly 1 to 2 metres, and up the east coast it's around about 0.5 to 1.5 metres, although tending more southwesterly offshore in the south. Our Maria Island wave rider buoy is about 1.2 metres significant wave height at the moment. And I do have an interesting stat for the weekend. So the Spring Bay tide gauge in the south on Saturday night, it was observed to be 2.194 metres, and that's possibly the highest ever recorded at the site. So pretty big tides over the weekend.
Yeah, I reckon. Okay. So anything else that we need to know?
No, not really. Good. The good news is with the tides is that we're not likely to see as high tides as what we've been seeing over the weekend. So things are returning to more normal. But having said that, it's still a very wintry week for Tassie.
Okay. Thanks for that, Luke. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tony.
Luke Johnston from the Bureau there with all the information that you need. If you've just tuned in, some great news from Tokyo. Ariane Titmus, the Launceston girl, has won the 400 metres freestyle against her great American counterpart, Katie Ledecky. And didn't break the world record, but she broke the world record for the biggest smile. Fantastic. Great news for Australia and for Tasmania at the Tokyo Olympics. Another gold medal. Well, if you go to our ABC Rural Facebook page, you put another smile on your face too, because we've asked you to send a selfie with your favourite farm animal. Lots of great pics to look at. Carolyn has got a pic of her lamb, and he's got a funny look on his face, and she says, "I just told my ram lamb, Cyrus, that I'm not his biological mum." You can see the disappointed look on the ram's face. Pete says, "I think I was the animal in my dog's selfie." have a look at our ABC Rural Facebook page for those pics.
Drive with Kylie Baxter.
Finding and telling stories.
I've been working with people in story all my life. I was asked to join the history team doing some transcribing of convict records. But I was just amazed at the records that we have here and that the stories that lie behind all of those records.
Drive with Kylie Baxter.
And it was quite mind-boggling.
Weekdays from 4 p.m.
And I just loved it.
On ABC Radio Hobart.
Air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
By the way, also on our ABC Rural Facebook page, you'll see the lovely story of the Nubina CWA and the extra members there. A couple of comments. Crystal says, and this is the good side of people relocating to rural areas, people to engage in the community. Alison jokes, my son calls in the Chinwagging Association, or calls it the Chinwagging Association, very tongue-in-cheek. Thank you, Alison. And Derek says, CWA is such an important institution that needs regrowth for country folk in particular. That's on our ABC Rural Facebook page and also ABC Rural Online. Well, we live in an age of big data where millions of pieces of information are generated every day. But on farm, how do you navigate through that sea of information and use it to your advantage? David McLean is Chief of Delivery at agricultural consulting firm RCS Australia. He's told Lachlan Bennett farmers can start by working out why exactly they are collecting data. And then they have to make sure what's happening in the office is connected to what's actually going on in the paddock.
The key one is about getting to know what's actually happening in their own business. And so we need to have some meaningful information. If we're going to make decisions, there's two key things that we need. We need to have some meaningful information and we need to know what we're trying to achieve. What's the outcome that we're aiming for? And also the importance of just knowing what you're trying to achieve. You can't make a decision unless you've got an outcome in mind.
And when you're in the thick of the day-to-day operations of farming, you don't always have time to sort of sit back and look at all the various bits of data. What's your advice for trying to manage those two things?
Really comes back to making sure that the hard work that is going on outside is the right work, and that the decisions that we're making are the ones that are going to create the lifestyle and the business performance that we want, and we don't get caught in that busyness to do the things that actually are working against us. And so shifting that focus, so the motivation for spending that time and that analysis is to make sure that all the effort and the hard work and the blood and sweat and tears are creating a real outcome that they want.
And I guess there's also sometimes a disconnect between what happens in the office and what's actually going on out in the paddock.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to talk about that and hopefully try to bridge that. And that's really important that we do bridge that that gap or that dichotomy that's happening between paddock and office.
Is it just a communication issue, or is it something cultural that leads to this disconnect?
I think the reason for it comes back to is that most analysis that's happening or most information is being done for mandatory purposes. It's being done for somebody else. You're doing it because you're doing tax because the ATO requires us to do it, or we're doing work because maybe the bank has requested it, and we're not actually doing it for us. So if we're going to have some connection between the paddock and the office, we need to shift it around that we're actually doing this office work and this analysis for us. It's for our benefit, not for somebody else's.
Because sometimes you can collect data and some of it's useful, some of it's mandatory, and some of it's just a waste of time.
Absolutely, yep. So that's one of those things with that meaningful information. And data by itself is really distracting. We need to make it meaningful.
And we're at a point in time where conditions are pretty good, commodity prices are great. Is that the time where we should be having these broader discussions about business analysis?
Absolutely. I am fearful around complacency, and Jane Weatherly mentioned that this morning in her presentation that there's DAF have mentioned a 43% chance of a disease outbreak in Australia in the next 4 or 5 years. And so if we have had any complacency tick into the business as a result of these beautiful periods that we've been experiencing in prices and seasons in the last little while, and that's allowed our cost of production to go up, and we don't know what that is for the first point, then do something about it, then we're very exposed. And so I think there is a lot of risk around that, and I'd hate to see people get put off balance in their business through complacency.
So if there's a farmer out there who's listening to this and says, right, this is probably an area of my operation I'm not doing too well, what are the first steps they should take?
Start to bridge that paddock to office divide would be the first one I'd suggest, and start to look at what is actually happening in their business, and that's about looking at do the numbers for you and take into account not only your cash movements but your non-cash movements. So what's actually happening with your balance sheet? What's happening with your livestock numbers and your change in livestock numbers? There's no short answer with that. We spend 7 days in grazing for profit going through this answer. The reality is, I'd say, get some numbers and meaningful information for yourself.
And are there any common mistakes or pitfalls you see people having?
Doing the analysis for somebody else, not for you. That'd be the main one. It's going through the motions because that's what you believe somebody else needs, and we need to take ownership. It's our, you know, if we're a business owner, it's our multi-million dollar operation.
And obviously that leads to a lot of opportunities and good futures for operations if that's done right.
Absolutely. I mean, everyone in the industry is so passionate about it, and we want to see them doing what they're doing for decades and generations to come.
That's David McLean of RCS Australia chatting to Lachlan Bennett about collecting good data and bridging the divide between the office and the paddock. Well, what's going on with fertiliser prices, I hear you ask? The first quarter of 2021 saw a 24% spike in fertiliser prices, according to the World Bank's Fertiliser Price Index. Hugo Rickard-Bell spoke to business analyst for Right Mind, David Hanlon, to find out what's driving the higher prices. He says there are a number of contributing factors.
Look, if you go back to basics, who's buying? So what countries, what crops are buying? Who's supplying? And then there are how they're getting it from A to B. So if you look at those, we've seen incredible increases in demand in the Northern Hemisphere, first of all, so that precedes us. India just had a massive crop coming through. The US and Europe had good crops. And now we're seeing in our local reports, Hugo, we're seeing the centre of the heat wave knocking crops about in the US, but they got the crop in. So they needed all the basics to get that started. The second thing in the Southern Hemisphere, Brazil has been increasing its crop capacity by about 5% per annum for the last 4 or 5 years. Really, 8% per annum, really good growth. And that's increasing demand. Both India and Brazil have been historically huge importers of fertiliser. If you look at supply, during the last half of last year and early this year, we've had two major urea factories go offline. The second thing that we've seen is that there's been an huge increase in gas input, gas prices, and that's because of the exceptionally cold winter in the Northern Hemisphere. So that's made the supply, two drivers of increasing the supply, Hugo. The third one is shipping prices. Now, freight prices for fertiliser have doubled in the first 6 months of this year. So you add all those in, and the final one on shipping is that we've had delay, you know, disrupted to shipping supplies. COVID did that. So, you know, there's a logistic logjam there.
Whereabouts were those major urea factories?
Oh, the main one was in Saudi. That happened. We've had some breakdowns in Malaysia, so we've just seen those couple of things happen, and hence, you know, in WA now we're seeing them really seriously looking at building a urea plant there to actually capitalise on these high prices and to get some local demand.
So basically, I mean, to summarise. A hot summer in the US, a cold winter in Europe, and a urea factory in Saudi Arabia can affect fertiliser prices all the way in the Northern Territory.
With one correction, the US had a big planting. The planting was right, so they required increased demand. The summer's going to knock down their output.
Mm. You mentioned that the price of oil and gas can really impact the, you know, fertiliser prices. How does that work?
Well, we've seen, so if you look at gas is a big driver of the price of particularly urea production, and the very, very cold winters in both the US and Europe have driven the spot price of gas northward enormously. So that's helped, you know, the base cost price of the product has gone up, Hugo. Couple that with the demand, couple that with that, you know, couple of factory hiccups, we've had that spike. And you know, people who, I was just talking the other day, because I'm redoing a project for a client at the moment, and I was talking to a good accumulator for big rural clients of fertiliser. Those guys who locked in, and I'm talking locked in January or earlier for their winter fertiliser, are doing a lot better than those who are scrambling now to pick up, because it's just not the product in the pipeline that merchants here, retailers here, can get it out to them.
So, David, how do you see this panning out from your perspective?
Crystal balls are always something to be wary of. Look, can I say, and it's so easy to be the expert in hindsight, but, you know, I follow most of the pundits to try and keep an eye on it. And when we look at probably the World Bank, are softer on prices. Certainly Rabo, when they gave their global outlook in January this year, expected prices to soften or stabilise in the second quarter and soften thereafter this year. Well, we're already in quarter three and seeing the spikes that generated this conversation. There's another global rater that I follow, who Finch Rated. They've absolute just of 3 weeks ago, they've revised all their ratings for both the rest of this year, next year, and coming back to 2023. So it's really interesting. While the World Bank expects things to be pretty well back to normal next year, we see that the Finch ratings, they're a global ratings on a whole lot of different commodities, they're still seeing that prices will be significantly above but lower than the second half of this year in 2022 for quite a few of the commodities. Urea, they expect perhaps to come back. Ammonia is going to still be up higher than it is was at the beginning of this year. We're going to see rock phosphate higher. We're going to see potash perhaps dropping back at the end of 2022.
Business analyst for Ridemind, David Hanlon, talking to Hugo Rickard-Bell about the rising cost of fertiliser. Well, finally, today, first found in the Torres Strait in January 2020, fall armyworm moths have led a successful aerial invasion, travelling up to 400 kilometres a night, including to Tasmania. The caterpillars have been found munching on crops and pastures in all parts of the country, except South Australia. Modern insecticides are still the first port of call for many farmers first grappling with the pest, but as Jennifer Nichols reports, beneficial insects are proving a chemical-free option.
Dairy farmer Don Davies immediately sought help when he spotted caterpillars damaging a field of young corn at Kooya on Queensland's Darling Downs in January.
When it was about 6 weeks of age, I just noticed some grub holes in it. Then I found quite a few that had a lot of grub holes in. I didn't really want to use chemicals on it, but I rang Bugs for Bugs and asked them, and I sent a picture and he said it was fall armyworm.
Paul Jones from Bugs for Bugs breeds predatory species of insects and mites for release on farms.
We're doing roughly around 12 different species of beneficials. We've got three locations, a base in Donnybrook, which is just north of Caboolture on the Sunshine Coast, base at Toowoomba, and base at Mundubbera. In all those locations, we mass rear different types of beneficials,
including ladybirds, lacewings, pirate bugs and tiny parasitoid Trichogramma wasps, all biological allies against fall armyworm. Don Davies ordered Trichogramma wasp eggs. They arrived by mail.
Well, I just walked all around the corn and dropped these little postage-sized stamps, then they just hatch out the next day and they just start breeding.
The Trichogramma wasp lay their eggs into the eggs of fall armyworms, hatching to devour the developing caterpillar inside. They help prevent more damage to the corn.
There were some stalks quite devastated with it, but they recovered quite good once the Trichogramma wasp turned up.
Mr. Davies is a third-generation dairy farmer who is focused on improving his land for his herd of Illawarra cows.
We're probably doing multi-species cropping probably 30 years now, and we never have to use fertiliser on it. It's been cropped for over 100 years and still growing really good crops.
Brassicas like turnips, as well as clover and herbs, provide habitat to beneficial insects that also attack the fall armyworms in the corn crop.
We were counting up to 200 beneficials per metre in the crop, and there was up to like 7 different lady beetles, and there was all these other natural predators there as well as these Trichogramma wasps, so they just seem to get right on top of it, fall armyworm.
Overseas, crops have been genetically modified to help them ward off fall armyworm. They've developed a high resistance to synthetic pyrethroids and moderate resistance to carbamate insecticides. Paul Jones again.
So growers have been using a lot of chemicals to control the pest, but because it's so prolific and aggressive, and the resistance factor is such a big issue, very difficult to control. So we're working on a premise of the more diverse and the higher the density of beneficials, the better.
And I imagine breeding these beneficial insects and being able to use them would be a hell of a lot more cost-effective than spraying expensive chemicals everywhere, especially if they're not working.
Look, I'd have to say bugs aren't cheap, and they're probably equivalent to the expensive chemicals. There's a lot of labour inputs in producing bugs, but the outcome is far more profitable to the grower if he doesn't have to spray and he's coming out with a crop which is not damaged with the pest.
In Australia, chemical effectiveness has varied in different parts of the country.
Well, I think that there are some real challenges with getting insecticides to where fall armyworm are, whereas for parasitoids and predators, that's much less of a challenge. You know, they can get down into little nooks and crannies and under the leaves and so on much more easily than a grower could get, you know, droplets of insecticide. So I think that that's one of the real advantages.
Melina Miles is the principal entomologist with the Queensland Government's Field Crops Entomology Team based in Toowoomba. She says four types of modern chemicals are widely used against fall armyworm.
Well, I think because of the sort of dramatic nature and the rapid crop losses that can occur, the response has been to attack fall armyworm with insecticides. So that currently is the mainstay.
The caterpillars favour maize, sweet corn, sorghum, capsicum and C4 pastures, including Rhodes grass, which are more adapted to warm or hot seasonal conditions when fall armyworm are most active. Lately, they've targeted wombok, also known as Chinese cabbage.
Visually, the impact of fall armyworm on vegetative crops is really dramatic, and it's something that growers and their advisors have not had to deal with before. So the visual impact is really quite confronting, but ultimately the impact on yield has been relatively minor in crops where they have been able to establish them. But sweet corn, I guess, is a different kettle of fish because, you know, the bar is so much higher in terms of quality.
An emergency permit has also been issued for Fallagen, a very specific nucleopolyhidrosis virus that has organic certification and can be sprayed out on fields.
The objective is to get as much coverage as you can on the leaves, and as the larvae are eating, they'll take up these little virus particles.
Melina Miles says it can be used in conjunction with beneficial insects because it's species specific.
The virus penetrates the gut and gets into the hemolymph and starts to replicate, and the larva stops feeding, and then the virus eventually starts to ooze out through the skin of the larva, and eventually it gets to the point where the larva disintegrates and releases all these virus particles into the crop.
As for dairy farmer John Davies, his corn crop may have survived fall armyworm, but it wasn't all good news.
No, we got a really bad mouse plague in them and they devastated it. So we controlled the new pest, but the old pest didn't. It's just farming,
win.
Isn't it?
Can't win, can you? Darling Downs dairy farmer Don Davies ended that report by Jennifer Nichols. And ending the Country Hour for today, don't forget ABC Rural Online and our ABC Rural Facebook page. We will catch you after midday tomorrow.